1-0. Launch to left field. Back goes Verdugo. He's going to run out of room. Home run number one for Spencer Torkelson. A two-run shot here in the seventh. On the hill for the Padres is Mackenzie Gore. Swing and a miss, and he strikes out Ozzie Albies to begin his Major League career. That is strike three. Second strikeout for Mackenzie Gore. The family loves it. Two down. Swing and a miss, and Albies strikes out. Strikeout number three for Mackenzie Gore. One down in the sixth inning.
Cracked. In the center field for a base hit. Torres around third. He's coming home to score. Kelnick slides into third base. Julio Rodriguez has made it a 2-0 Mariners lead in the fourth inning.
First big league ribby for Julio.
Here's a swing and a high fly ball out towards right center field. That one going back and it's gone. See you later. And Seiya Suzuki shoots that out into the jet stream. This one drilled in the air left field, way back there, and he's done it again. Seiya Suzuki goes yard.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, and the season is underway. And we have our eyes on prospects in both in the big leagues and in the minor leagues. We're going to take a look at some guys who are off to fast starts, both in MLB and MILB. One of those guys off to a fast start in the minors is Reds shortstop prospect Matt McClain. We're going to have a chat with him. And we are working on expanding our top draft prospects list from 100 to 150. That will be coming out soon, so we will talk about that a little bit, and we'll wrap up as we always do by answering a question from the mailbag. Jim, Jonathan, greetings.
Salutations.
Hello.
Both of you from your respective homes this time. Jonathan, if you deign to reveal your location.
That is correct.
Correct. All right. I want to know where you guys are at all times.
And Jason, fresh off a fire drill in the main office, so.
That's right.
What is your fire drill speed on the 20 to 80 scale?
No, it's not about speed, Jim. It's more
efficiency.
It's more about smarts and efficiency.
Isn't it about speed?
Well, there's an element of speed involved. There's an element of you got to know where to go is the main thing. That stairwell A is where I'll be going in case of emergency here. All right, so let's start in the big leagues. Oh, we have fire drill, hot prospects. I think our graphics even have some flames on them. Look at this. We have our first rookie hot list of the year going up as we record this on Tuesday. It's being produced ably by, I believe, by young Willie Kornblatt right now. That story should be up on MLB.com/pipeline momentarily. And basically every few weeks, we will look at the rookies in the big leagues who are the hottest over the course of the past few weeks, which is a little bit different from our rookie power rankings, in which we are ranking the rookies based on our expectations as to how they'll finish in the rookie of the year balloting at the end of the season. So two different things here, gauging rookies in the big leagues. And to start things off, this year, we have a rookie who doesn't really, as you guys said when we were talking about whether we should even discuss this guy, he's not really in our domain because while he's a rookie, he does not qualify for our prospect lists. But that is Seiya Suzuki of the Cubs. He's number one on our list of rookies off to the hottest starts. He's been absolutely blazing. And, you know, there were questions about how he would translate coming over from Japan. And so far, the early returns are that his skills have translated extremely well. Hit 400, 543, 960 over the course of the first week. Four home runs, 11 RBIs, 9 walks. Something I thought was interesting. We have a story on why this early success is sustainable by the fantastic Sarah Langs. And something that does pertain to us that I saw mentioned in here that I thought was interesting is that he has swung at fewer pitches. He's been more selective than all but two other hitters in the big league so far. Spencer Torkelson and G-Man Choi have swung at the fewest percentage of pitches they've seen this year. Does that surprise you about
Torkelson? I was just going to say that. You didn't give me the opportunity to answer, but No, yes. I mean, Torkelson doesn't surprise. I mean, it surprised me a little bit in that he's a rookie and it's his first taste of the big leagues, but he does have a really good eye at the plate. So I'm not in general surprised, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, even if he wasn't hitting seven homers opening week or putting up huge numbers, that's not a guy who's going to stray from the approach that got him there. So that's not too surprising.
And Suzuki, I was going to say, like with Suzuki, you know, I think in general, the Japanese players who've hit in Japan have generally hit in the United States. It's just you're never sure how the power is going to translate. And I don't know that Suzuki's going to hit four home runs every 10 days or whatever his pace is right now. But so far, so good. I mean, I think that was kind of the biggest question. And I mean, he's slugging 929. So in his first 10 days in the big leagues, the power has translated very, very well.
All right, so Suzuki is at the top of the list. He's followed by Stephen Kwan at number two, who we spoke extensively about last week on the podcast. Number three on the list, Spencer Strider. Number four, Matt Brash. Number five, Hunter Green. Number six, Joey Bart. Seven, Joe Ryan. Eight, Seth Beer. Nine, Jeremy Pena. And 10, the aforementioned Spencer Torkelson. Guys, who stood out to you off of this list so far?
I'm going to start with Spencer Strider. He's the Braves' number two prospect. Kind of just a crazy story because he'd had Tommy John surgery, hadn't thrown a lot, got drafted in the 2020 draft, and then last year basically pitched his way across all of the minor leagues. And now, you know, he's pitching out of the bullpen and doing so very well, almost too well, because I do think he has a chance to start long term, but I'm wondering, how long they keep him in the bullpen. He's got 11 strikeouts in 9 innings. He's always had a very good fastball, but in the shorter stints, I mean, he's been averaging close to 98 miles per hour with a fastball with good spin rates. He's topped out at 100, and he couples it with a really, really nasty mid-80s slider that has been up to about 87, 88 miles per hour. So, and he misses a lot of bats with that too. So those two pitches alone, he could pitch in the back end of a bullpen for a very, very long time. But I do think that he does have the ability to start long-term. We'll see where it goes. But a very encouraging beginning for him in the big leagues with the Braves. And, the more he does this, the more high-leverage situations I think we're going to see him in.
I was going to say, I'll just continue down on the list and go with the next guy, Matt Brash, who we added to the top 100 prospects list this offseason. I had one scout who told me that his team evaluated Matt Brash as having the best breaking ball in the entire minor leagues. And he really has two really good breaking balls. I mean, he's had two starts so far, could battle the control a little bit, but 12 strikeouts and 10 and two thirds innings, only given up 6 hits. And this is a guy who's only pitched 55 innings in the minors before coming to the big leagues this year. He was a fourth round pick out of Niagara by the Padres and pitched 5 innings, 5 good innings in the minors at the end of the 2019 season, but 5 innings total. And then was kind of off to on his own during the pandemic, and the Mariners asked for him and got him as the player to be named in a trade for Taylor Williams, who's not even with the Padres anymore. And Brash's stuff has just taken off. But if you've seen the highlights, his slider has so much horizontal movement. It's ridiculous. And he throws it hard. It's a mid-80s slider. And it also has depth to the point where I think sometimes people mistake the depth on it for a curve. And he's also got, more of a curveball that, still has a lot of horizontal movement, not quite as much, and more depth, and is a couple miles an hour slower. And his balls just move so much, those breaking pitches, that they're impossible to hit. And oh, by the way, he averages 96 miles an hour with a four seamer, the up in the strike zone. And so if you're trying to sit on that, then you're really victimized by the breaking stuff. So he's been really fun to watch. I mean, it's not the smoothest delivery. It's not the most strikes in the world. So I do think there's some reliever risk, although in today's game, I mean, maybe it's not so much reliever risk as maybe he's more, four inning starter risk And those guys are quite valuable. He's just fun to watch. I mean, I don't know how anybody hits his stuff because it just moves so much. It's impossible.
Yeah, he is a lot of fun to watch. I saw that his first start and five of his six strikeouts were on the breaking ball. And then I didn't see the second one, but just looked it up quickly. And out of his strikeouts in that game, three of them on sliders as well. So that all checks out. All right. So again, that story, the hottest rookies in the big leagues, is up on MLB.com/pipeline. Also on the site is our first prospect team of the week. Now, this is one player per position, and these are all guys in the minor leagues. And we do this on a weekly basis. And our first team of the week has a couple of guys, Jim and Jonathan, that you guys want to focus on. And I would say that we don't name a player of the week, but I would have to think that if we did, Nolan Gorman might be that individual.
Maybe we should name a player of the week.
Yeah, seriously, that's not a bad idea.
And then that could be an easy lead, and then on to the team.
No, there we go. We've just revolutionized the prospect team of the week right here.
Brainstorming on the air. It's exciting. Nolan Gorman, would be hard to pick someone who had a better start, you know, to the season of the last week. Six homers in six games, all solo homers, which is weird, but it's neither here nor there. Six of his 11 hits were homers. And, we've always known about his power pretty much since he was a first rounder back in 2018. It showed up. He had 25 homers last year between double and triple A. He's going to strike out. That's just the fact of the matter. And, he's got overall 15 strikeouts this year in 10 games and 41 plate appearances. He had nine in this past week, but no one's going to care if he's getting to the power like this. Now he's not going to get to the power at this rate regularly. I think the only questions now are, when might he get called up and can he play second base at the big league level? We're gonna have to wait and see on that.
And he's got Tommy Edman in his way too, who continues to play well for the Cardinals.
Right. That's the other thing. Now, Tommy Edman does have the ability to move around if the Cardinals wanted to do that and, make room for Gorman's bat. I don't think you bring Nolan Gorman up and have him move around. Although he's a pretty good third baseman. Obviously, they don't need him at third with Nolan Arenado, but he hasn't played anywhere else. Tommy Edman, can kind of play all over the place. And I'm wondering if that's eventually what they do. For now, Gorman can continue to see advanced pitching in AAA and wait by the phone.
Yeah, you would think maybe he could cobble together some at-bats, playing second, filling in at third when Arenado gets a day off, and then with DH as well. Of course, they signed Albert Pujols, who's pretty much only going to DH. And you also have Gorman's AAA teammate, Juan Yepes, who's another candidate to get some DH at-bats and is off to a very good start. So kind of crowded spot there for Gorman. Jim, who you got?
I'm going to go with Jordan Brewer, who's fascinated me for a while. He's with the Astros, outfielder. He had a big week as well, hit .444 with an ops over 1,600, three homers, three steals. He's a potential, at least 2020 guy. And he just really needs to play. He was a guy who was actually a wide receiver on Michigan's radar, the University of Michigan's radar, as a wide receiver before he hurt his shoulder as a high school senior. So he went the JUCO baseball route and wound up joining the Wolverines, part of their baseball team that came within a win of the national championship in 2019. He was Big Ten Conference Player of the Year and a third round pick and, really interesting athlete. And he's barely played. He had a toe injury that he played through in college that kind of limited him in his pro debut. Then he injured his knee and had surgery. So even if we had not had the pandemic wipe out the 2020 season, he would have missed that season. And they brought him back slowly. So he only played half a year last year. So he's a guy who really needs at bats. He's already 24. He's in high A, but it's a really, really good athlete. It's well above average speed. It's plus raw power. It's not the smoothest right-handed swing. There is some swing and miss in his game, So far so good. He's walked more than he struck out in the very early going. But if he can, manage his at-bats well, I mean, this is a guy who, could be, 20-plus home run guy, 30-plus steals, and play you pretty solid center field. And he throws well enough to handle right field if he has to move to a corner. So, I think in turn, the Astros system is not one of our higher ranked farm systems. They've promoted a lot of guys. They've traded a lot of guys. I do think that Brewer has one of the highest ceilings in their system. And if they can keep him healthy and get him going this year, he's going to shoot up their prospect list. He's only number 21 on the list right now, but he can really shoot up.
Some other notable names on the first prospect team of the week of the year. There's a pretty big NL Central contingent there. As a matter of fact, along with Nolan Gorman, there are two other Cardinals on the team, both pitchers. The right-handed pitcher is Gordon Graceffo, and the relief pitcher is Freddy Pacheco, who I will never not think of the fight doctor when I see that name.
That's Freddy Pacheco, isn't it?
I know. The relief doctor. And Mason Martin, notable because of the fact that he is now the current leader in Prospect Team of the Week appearances. The all-time leader is Kyle Tucker, who made the team 11 different times. Usually, with minor league situations like that, you kind of think like a career leader, you typically don't want to be on a list like that. But, the case with Tucker, he was just good for a long time as he was making his way up and then kind of got stuck there at AAA for a bit. But 11 appearances on Prospect Teams of the Week. Mason Martin makes his seventh team. Another NL Central prospect on the list is Matt McClain, who we mentioned in the intro we're going to talk to, and we're going to do that right after this on the MLB Pipeline podcast.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline podcast. Jonathan Mayo here along with Jim Collison. We're very pleased to welcome on to the show the Reds' first round pick from a year ago. Still basking in the glow of making the Pipeline Prospect Team of the Week, I'm sure. It's Matt McClain joining us from, I think you're in Mississippi, Matt. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Pearl, Mississippi. We're playing the Braves.
Well, thank you for joining us. Let's start with the most recent because you go straight to Double A to start your first full year, and seem to clearly hit the ground running. All jokes aside, making the prospect team of the week, hitting for the cycle last week. I guess if you were to draw it up, and how you would get started in your first full season, it would look something like this.
Well, it's funny you say that because we went to play the Cubs north of Knoxville, and it was 30 to 40 degrees, and it was windy, and I punched out probably more than half my at-bats to start that weekend. And because I never played at UCLA, I never played in a game that cold, so I'm not blaming it on the cold, but it was an actual tough first couple games. But yeah, the last couple of days was good.
Matt, Jim Callis here. Yeah, I saw Sunday you drew a lot of attention. You hit for the cycle, and you took only 7 pitches to do it. Is that the first time you ever hit for the cycle? And it seems like a lot of times in the cycle you need the triple in the last at-bat, which you needed and got. Were you thinking triple going into that last? What was that whole experience like? You didn't waste much time with doing it on 7 pitches.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think that I've hit for the cycle. I can't remember. I've been asked that a couple times. I can't remember one. I feel like I would remember. But yeah, the 7 pitches thing is cool. The last one was the triple. We got the big walls up in Chattanooga that are wood. So it did help me. I don't think the outfielders really wanted to bash into the wall going for the ball. So they watched it bounce off the wall, and I'm like, I'm going to third. It was probably a triple. I stretched it a little bit for sure, but I was safe. There was no throw. I think the relay was a little bit offline. I watched it on video.
I think, as time goes on, especially if you don't do this again, that was a single you stretched into a triple. You got to embellish a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Make it a better story. Yeah. Like, oh, he tripped. I tripped. I was at second and ran to third.
You get it. That's excellent. Was going straight to double A something that you had set as a goal heading in? You know, you're kind of entered pro ball, you know, coming into the draft as a, you know, that sort of quote unquote advanced college hitter, a guy who could move pretty quickly. The Reds don't hesitate to kind of push guys aggressively. Was after your pretty good summer debut, was this something you're like, all right, maybe I can kind of push things a little bit and start in double A, or were you surprised at all by that?
No, not necessarily. I didn't really assume I was going to go play anywhere because that's really out of my control at the end of the day. And I was always taught from a young age, control what you can. So wherever I was going to play this year, wherever I'm going to play this year, I kind of tried to tune that out as much as I can. You know, like people talk about it, stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I'm me and I'm going to play my game no matter where I am. It's not really going to change how I play. So I tried not to worry too much about it.
You, Matt Johnson, was joking with you about making prospect team of the week and what a lofty honor that is. I wonder who had the best week in the McLean family last week. Was it you or was it your brother Sean, who went 11 for 16 and was Pac-12 player of the week at Arizona State? And then part two of the question is, you went to UCLA. How do you let your brother go to Arizona State? How did that happen?
Yeah, so a couple. So he actually called me, like we talk all the time. We're best friends, me, Sean, and Nick. And, He was giving me grief about hitting with Major League Baseballs. And he said, oh, yeah, you only hit a couple out because it was – and I did hit one homer off a position player. So that was definitely brought up multiple times. Because he didn't have any homers, but he had 11 hits. But, yes, he had a really good week. I would say he had a better week this week. And what was the other part of that?
You know, as a UCLA guy, how do you let your brother go to Arizona State? How does that happen?
Yeah, he's different. Well, we play the same positions for one, and two, he wanted to be away from everything. I mean, he visited ASU with my dad in high school, and he loved it. And it's a really good spot for him, honestly. Yeah, he loves it. He loves going to the field every day and playing. It's a really good program over there.
Yeah, Jim makes it sound like he went to some D3 school in New Hampshire. I'm going to go. My son goes to a D3 school in Connecticut, so I was not sort of throwing shade on that one. You need to throw back at him that you hit with wood, by the way. Like he's complaining that you're hitting Major League Baseball.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, I just let him talk his smack. Yeah, he says congrats, you hit a homer with a couple Major League Baseballs, and then he pulled up the position player homer. He found it. That was the first one. It was off position.
It still counts, man. It still counts.
Yeah.
I did want to, you know, since we're talking about your brother and you brought up Nick, you know, who is also beginning his college career. What is going on in the McLean house that all three of you are this good? You know, and at what point did you realize that this was something kind of special? I mean, you're the oldest one, so you kind of had the bird's eye view, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, my senior year, it was Sean's junior year and Nick's freshman year at Beckman. When we all got to play together in the same team, that was really cool because we had never done that. Me and Sean always played together. Sean and Nick never really played together. They did a little bit, but we were certainly never three all on the same team because me and Nick are kind of far in age. But that year we did, and it was really cool. And, yeah, that was kind of the point where I was like, dang, this is special. But, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, Matt, going back to your decision, I mean, you're one of the few players in draft history who's actually been a first-round pick twice. Were you close to signing with the Diamondbacks at all? And then, you know, you didn't have the easiest freshman season at UCLA. You played center field. You hit 200 or 203, I'll be fair, 203.
Thank you.
Struggled a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, what was the decision-making process like? And then how tough was that first year at UCLA?
Oh, yeah. I was kind of close to signing, I guess you could say. I knew I always wanted to go to UCLA. My number obviously wasn't met, but I always wanted to go to UCLA regardless. So at the end of the day, it really came down to what I wanted to do versus the money. And I made that clear from the start. It didn't end up like – took a couple left turns, right turns, but I ended up at UCLA where I wanted to be. And then, yeah, that freshman year was tough. I had never done that before. That jump is no joke. I didn't necessarily think it was going to be easy, but it was definitely harder than I thought it was going to be. So I knew I had to get better. It was a wake-up call. It was humbling. I don't consider myself cocky, but on the inside, like confident, it was definitely humbling and knowing like, dang, dude, like you got to get better. And it's like that in pro ball now too. Like you realize, okay, dude, if you really want to do this, you still have to get better like every single day, because everyone at this level is doing the same thing, trying to reach the big leagues. And then when you get to the big leagues, you're going to struggle there too. And you're like, got to get better.
I was going to ask, a lot of times, people in player development say that they want guys in the minors to hit that adversity, to hit that bump, because sometimes you have success, and then you get to the big leagues and it can smack you in the face. How much do you think that tough freshman year at UCLA has helped inform you, knowing like, all right, that's going to come, and I also can push past it and get to that point where like, all right, I have to keep working to get better.
Yeah. I think looking back on it, that's like one of the biggest things, is to know that I can hit that wall and I can kind of get through it and push through it and have confidence in myself to know that, I'm a good enough player, I'm a hard enough worker, to where I'm going to get better and learn from my failures, as opposed to, just be mad or pissed off about them all the time, because I learned a lot from that year. Not even so much about like, swing approach, but just like how to go about it every single day. And in pro ball, it's honestly easier when you have a bad game, because you're showing up the next day. In college, you don't always show up the next day to play. You got practice and stuff. You don't play every day. But in pro ball, sometimes like I like it, because like you go for one night, the next day, like right away, you're back in there ready to go. Not that much long after you just went over the night before. And it's kind of a test every time it happens to myself, like how fast can you flush it, because it's not going to be the last time it happens.
In terms of getting better, Matt, what are you working on specific developmental, aspects of your game, whether it's hitting or fielding, or is it still early enough in your pro career that the Reds have mostly said, kind of roll out there and play and we'll see what it looks like and go from there?
I'm certainly like working on things, but in general, yeah, I'm just trying to get better. Like, I'm just trying to hit the ball harder consistently. I'm getting better at shortstop, trying to steal more bags. I've learned a couple things about stealing bases, which is cool, because I was always fast, but I didn't always know how to steal bases. I was kind of just running because I was fast. Now I'm learning like the counts, stuff to look at, how each pitcher's start is a little bit different, just like little things like that.
Jim and I, we write all these reports and blurbs on you guys, and that would, I believe the axiom we would overuse there would be, learning the nuances of the craft.
Yeah.
When it comes to stealing bases.
Trying to.
Yeah, trying, right. As you said, like that's never going to stop for you, even when you're at the big league level.
For sure.
I wanted to ask you about your defense a little bit, because, ever since your high school days, I think everyone has been wanting to make you a second baseman. Except for you. And I know you, Jim mentioned you had to play center, at UCLA, out of necessity, but how intent are you on proving people who thought, all right, maybe he doesn't have the arm, maybe it'll look better from second base, even if you end up at second base when all said and done because of big league personnel, like how important is it to you to prove skeptics that you actually can play shortstop at this level?
I want to do it for me more than anyone. Like, proving people wrong is cool and all, but like, I know I can play shortstop, so I want to prove it to myself at the highest level. But at the end of the day, like, I'm a ball player and I'm going to play wherever the team needs me. But yes, I do like shortstop the best.
That's the right answer, by the way, if the Reds are listening.
Matt, I always like to ask guys their impressions of other players. I know you haven't been in pro ball for a real long time yet, but who's the best pitcher you've seen in pro ball? It could even be a teammate or somebody you saw in instructional league or spring training, but who do you think is the best pitcher you've faced in pro ball to this point, or most impressive pitcher you've seen?
I think Espino with the Guardians. I faced him a couple times. He throws cheese.
I saw him, just to follow up on that, I saw him. I don't remember if you were in the game, but I saw a backfields game in the middle of March where he faced 10 hitters and struck out 7, including Nick Senzel twice. I don't think you were in that game, were you?
No, I wasn't in that game, but I actually did hear about it. I was on the other field right next to it.
Yeah, he was ridiculous. That day he struck out Senzel on like 102-mile-an-hour fastball and I think a 93-mile-an-hour slider, and his curveball was like 85 to 87. It was literally the best stuff I've ever seen. So I may have the same answer as you, Matt. It was ridiculous.
And he mixes it up pretty well. It's not like you can sit up, like you almost have to like look for his fastball, but he'll mix in breakers 1-0, 2-0. And you're like, dude, you throw it 100. Like, let's throw the fastball.
you didn't even hesitate to answer that question. I mean, he popped right in your head right away.
Yeah, well, because we share the complex, and I saw him a couple times in Lake County in Dayton last year. So I've seen him probably four different starts. He's been pretty good in all of them.
How about within your own organization? One thing that the Reds have, is there's some depth up the middle, guys who can move around. You know, a guy who's created a lot of buzz is Ellie De La Cruz. I don't know how much time you got to interact with him. You know, I think aside from your advanced, you know, bat to ball skills, one reason you're in Double A is just so you guys can both get reps at shortstop. You know, you can't all play shortstop all at the same time. What did you see from him and maybe, you know, some of the other top prospects that you've been around in the organization?
Yeah, Ellie's funny. He's good. He's trying to learn some more English. I'm trying to learn some more Spanish. So we help each other on that. But he's got some juice and he's fat. He's fun to watch run the bases. I can learn some things from him. Like he's so tall and he gets around the bases so fast. It's fun to watch. But yeah, the Reds do have a lot of good prospects and honestly, just a lot of good people. You know, I got to face a lot of guys, Lodolo, Ashcraft, just guys like that in spring training. They're good.
All right, Matt, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out on your road trip right there. Good luck as things go along. I'm hoping maybe we see you at the Futures game, in Los Angeles.
I don't know. Is it in Anaheim or Dodgers?
Dodger Stadium.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Kind of the backyard. We'll see how that goes. But good luck the rest of the way. Thanks for joining us. And congratulations on a fantastic start. Matt McClain with the Reds organization. We'll be right back after this. Much more to come on the MLB Pipeline podcast.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. Thanks very much to Matt McClain for joining us on the show today. Now we're going to turn our attention to the draft. We are in the process of expanding our 2022 top draft prospects list from 100 to 150. Jim and Jonathan, as you have done that, what are some things that have stood out to you during the process?
Well, I think the one that stands out more than anything, just because nobody can remember it being like this, and we've talked about this before, is just the number of pitchers who aren't pitching for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, just on the college side, you know, Blade Tidwell of Tennessee's back, but he's only pitched a little bit. He had some shoulder issues. At least he's pitching. But Connor Prelip at Alabama is not going to pitch. Carson Wisenant, he's coming back from Tommy John surgery. He'll throw some bullpens and maybe he'll pitch in the Cape. Maybe Carson Wisenant in East Carolina got suspended for the entire season. Landon Sims blew out his elbow at Mississippi State and had Tommy John surgery. Payne Pellett blew out his elbow at Arkansas before the season, as did Henry Williams at Duke. And they both had Tommy John surgery. Kumar Rocker is still, after failing the medical exam with the Mets last year and getting offered the grand total of $0 to sign because the Mets did not want to sign him. They just wanted the pick back. There's really not even word. And everybody suspects that he'll pitch an independent ball, but here we are in mid-April. There's no word of that. And then you go to the high school side. Dylan Lesko has been great. He was great at the NHSI. Now he's got a sore arm. You know, people aren't sure exactly what's up with that. Noah Schultz, interesting lefty from up here in Illinois. He came down with mono after he pitched a grand total of two innings, and he's not going to do anything for a month, and nobody knows how quick he will be able to build back his arm and pitch. And even Cole Phillips, who was like the big emerging high school pitcher in Texas, up to 100 miles an hour, he was making a push for the first round. He blew out his arm and had Tommy John surgery. So I know I just talked for a really long time, but and I may be forgetting somebody too, Jonathan, I don't know. But it's unbelievable. I don't even know how many guys I just named there, but all those guys were at worst top 50 picks. Most of those guys, first rounders, and outside of Blade Tidwell, who's pitched six innings now, none of them's pitching. It's insane.
Yeah. And it filters down. I mean, there are some guys who have stepped up and pitched well, and they're going to float up, you know, to sort of fill the void. But like, even further down the list, guys getting banged up, you know, even if it's just little minor things, you know, but here's a guy who's like performing really well, but he's got a shoulder thing now. So I, you know, don't know where to put him. And we're not a first round guy, but more a third or fourth round guy. And I think because of the injuries and then just in general, the college pitching crop this year wasn't great. There's not a lot of college pitching. And Jim, I don't know if you found this to be true, but then when I've talked to scouts about college hitters, especially guys who kind of pop up a little bit because they're performing so well, scouts aren't exactly sure what to do with some of the numbers because they don't feel, even in some of the bigger conferences, that the pitching's been that good. So you have guys, you know, who are putting up huge numbers who are like, oh, they're going to jump onto our top 150. Maybe they're even top 100 guys. But what do those numbers mean if in the ACC conference the pitching is way down? So I think that's been my takeaways as we've kind of drilled deeper into this list and build it out.
And I have heard that. And it's funny, too, because I don't know if you've gotten this, Jonathan, but like Friday night, if you're a scout, like not that you lock it in at the beginning of the year, but Friday night, you're going to see college pitching matchups. And if you're really lucky, you can see two good college pitchers going on a Friday night. And I've talked to more guys who are going to see high school games on Fridays because there's nobody to go see. Like from a college pitching standpoint, yeah. I do think, you know, we've talked about the big three high school guys, Drew Jones and Elijah Green and Termar Johnson at the top. And I do think the college hitting crop, while there have been some guys who've had disappointing years, the college hitting crop was fairly deep. So I think there's still going to be a good number of college hitters. But I'm wondering, A, because the industry as a whole doesn't like to take high school pitchers high anyway, and all the college pitchers seem to be hurt or not pitching. I'm wondering if A, we're going to see any pitchers taken the first 10 or 12 picks. I don't think it's impossible that it's a dozen straight hitters. I have no idea what the record is off the top of my head. And then B, I know we've sent out our list and we're getting a lot of feedback from people in the industry, our rough top 150 that we're still refining. And I do feel like, Jonathan, like I feel like we should just rip up like 22 through 40. I think our 22 through 40 when we're done is not going to look like our initial list we sent out. I already want to move guys around. The discussion for another time. I'm almost wondering if we should just take all the hurt and sideline pitchers and just throw them all together like in one big blob somewhere. because I don't know how you're supposed to distinguish between them. And we get the same thing. I mean, you've got it too. Like the most common refrain as we've gotten feedback is, I don't know what to tell you to do with any of the hurt pitchers. And it's like, I don't know what to do with them either.
Yeah. And most of the hurt pitchers are your guys. It just worked out that way. Right. So you're probably hearing that part more than me now that we're getting feedback on the overall list from different people. I am getting that. But as you're writing these guys up, you know, based on what they did in 2021, after a year where they barely played in 2020, maybe off of the summer. It's weird. It's definitely a strange time.
Okay, so who are some guys to keep an eye on when we expand the list here who are either making a big jump onto the list, somebody who wasn't on the list before making a big jump on, or someone who is currently on the list but making a big jump?
Well, I initially would have said Cole Phillips, who I just mentioned had Tommy John surgery. Cole Phillips is still going to factor pretty high, but the guy I wanted to spotlight is Ryan Cermak, who's an outfielder from Illinois State. And the Redbirds, you know, they've produced some early round picks who've become big leaguers in Paul DeJong and Owen Miller in recent drafts. And this guy, Cermak, has a better all around package of tools than either of them and could get drafted higher than them. DeJong was a fourth round pick, Owen Miller was a third round pick. And, you know, Cermak, you know, people knew he had some tools. He hit 11 home runs last year to lead Illinois State, you know, had some strikeouts, but he's just a much more well-rounded player this year. He's controlling the strike zone more. He homered in four consecutive at-bats about a week ago. The fourth home run, it was over two games, was a 470-foot blast. And then I had scouts who were at that weekend series, I think that was against Kansas, who saw the 470-foot homer and said he hit another homer on Sunday that might have gone even farther. I mean, he's big, he's right-handed. You know, there is still some swing and miss, but he's making a lot more consistent contact. It's well above average raw power. It's well above average speed. He can get down the first base line in less than 4.1 seconds. He's got a strong arm. He's been up to 95 miles an hour during a brief foray on the mound. He's center fielder who was Missouri Valley Conference Defensive Player of the Year last year. So if he hits, I mean, you could have a guy with four plus tools and an average bat. I think he's got a chance to go as high as the second round right now. And if he, last time I checked, he was hitting 380. And if he keeps that up, like, I don't know, I haven't looked at their schedule, if they've got a matchup against a particularly good pitcher, because as Jonathan mentioned, there really aren't that many particularly good pitchers who are healthy this year. But if he has a good matchup against a top pitching prospect, I'm sure he'll get a bunch of heat at that. And if he performs well there in this draft, if you told me he went 29th or something, I don't think it's different position than Trey Sweeney, but Trey Sweeney, who's at Eastern Illinois last year, went in the first round. I think Trey was a better pure hitter than Cermak, but didn't have the all around tools. I don't think it's impossible that Ryan Cermak could sneak into the first round because, scouts often tell us there's going to be 30 first round picks. It doesn't matter how thinned out the draft is by all these injuries. There's still going to be 30 first round picks. So somebody's got to go in the first round.
All right. So that's Ryan Cermak. Jonathan, I want to go Karnak the Magnificent here. I think you're going to tell us about Jacob Melton.
It's like you have a rundown in front of you or something. It's funny. We were joking about wanting to do the top 150 and just like going from like 15 to 40, and skipping those middle numbers just because someone's got to go in each of the spots. So, and Melton is similarly, a college performer, and that's why he's rising up. He's at Oregon State, obviously a very highly regarded team program in the Pac-12. And the one thing I think why he was kind of off the radar is he hasn't really played in the summers. He didn't play in the Cape or for Team USA last year. He had over 400 last year at Oregon State. And this year he's continued. He's hitting about close to 370. The power has started to show up. It's kind of sneaky pop. But the biggest thing that, in addition to his bat-to-ball skills and the power starting to show up, is he can really run, and he's showing that he can play center field. He had played a bunch of first base. He played some right field. He's not a first baseman just because that would be a waste of his speed. So he could probably play all three outfield spots if he needed him to, but he's got an above average arm. He has a good chance to stick up the middle, and he's hit. And those guys tend to creep up. I don't think he's a first rounder, but if he went in the second round somewhere just because of the performance, his left-handed hitter, good defensive abilities, it's solid tools across the board.
And you guys know I can't just say one name. I'm not going to break him down, but Campbell pitcher Thomas Harrington could sneak into the first round too. Just want to throw that in there.
Sneaking into the first round, like Jim sneaking another name into the answer of a question. All right.
Exactly.
So keep an eye out for our updated and expanded top draft prospects list that will be coming your way soon. Let's answer a question from the mailbag. This comes from Twitter handle @AdvancedStats23. Who asks, if Roki Sasaki were considered a prospect, where would he rank? And I guess if he were to be declared eligible now, he would qualify as a prospect, correct?
Correct.
I believe so, just because he's so young.
And he wouldn't be subject to the draft, but since we were just talking about the draft, I guess I looked at this two ways. I guess we need to explain who Roki Sasaki is, maybe, just to some of our listeners who threw like a perfect game with 19 strikeouts in Japan. He's 20 years old. And then in his next start, he came back and threw 8 more perfect innings before they pulled him, I guess, because of pitch counts. Pretty spectacular stuff. It's fastball, like, moves all over the place. Averages around 100 miles an hour. He's got I don't know if he calls it a splitter or a forkball that dives at the plate. His slider is his third pitch. But the combination of the way the splitter acts and the fastball acts, it literally has been impossible to hit so far this season. But I guess I was looking at it like kind of too prior. And since we're just talking about the draft, I do think, Jonathan, I don't even know if this is that bold given what we just said about the state of pitching. I don't think there's any question if he were in the draft, he'd be the first pitcher taken.
How could he not be?
Just a matter of how high would you take him in the draft. And I think, like, you could argue I mean, Drew Jones is pretty ridiculously talented. You know, it could be plus tools across the board. Elijah Green, you know, is hitting better this year, you know, or less swing and miss, and his tools are even louder than Drew Jones's. So maybe he's not the number one pick, but I mean, I feel like he'd definitely be the first pitcher taken and go somewhere in the first 3 to 5 picks, probably.
I think you could make the argument, you know, depending on what your organization is looking for, to take him number one, right?
Because
this is a guy, because he's doing it against a different level of competition than those high school hitters are in it. And I understand, as we often hammer the table about come draft time, you know, you want to take the guy who's going to be the best player long term, but Sasaki could be the best player long term and is going to help you out instantaneously. It's just insane. His numbers are 2 walks and 56 strikeouts in 31 innings.
So top 100, where you put him on your top 100 if he's eligible for the top 100, if he signed today.
Yeah. So I think if he signed today and you're putting him in the top 100, I think it's tough. Right around 7. I think I'd tuck him behind Grayson Rodriguez, but right in that top 10 area. What about you?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, I would take Grayson Rodriguez over him.
I think so.
Because I think Grayson's got more pitches that are spectacular, and I think his delivery's better. I mean, but it'd be pretty close. I would take him over Shane Baz, who's our next pitcher. And, yeah, I mean, it's just – then it becomes a matter of taste. Do you want Sasaki or do you want the Blue Jays' Gabriel Moreno, who we have at 7, or Anthony Volpe, who we have at 8? But he'd be in that 7 to 10 range somewhere. I think he's pretty interesting. Now we won't see him over here for several years, I wouldn't think. I mean, I don't know why Chiba would post him. I mean, like I think they'd rather keep him and reap the benefits of having him pitch for them. And by the time he is eligible for free agency, he no longer would qualify as a prospect. But it's a great question. What do you think, Jason? I mean, when they listening to this, what is your feeling on Roky Sasaki?
Man, it's hard not to think of, you know, when we dealt with the situation with Ohtani, and obviously that's a different situation because he was a hitter as well. And he was, you know, what did you guys say when we ranked Ohtani number one, that he could have potentially been top 10 overall as a pitcher or a hitter at that time? Is that
correct?
Yeah. I mean, I've never, and we saw last year why, I've never heard scouts talk about a player like they've talked about Ohtani. It was just, I mean, it's weird that, you know, he's, you know, the Japanese Babe Ruth, and that doesn't seem like hyperbole. And I mean, I think you could have ranked him. If you're inclined to rank a pitcher number one overall in the top 100, you could have ranked him number one either way. I mean, I'm looking here. We graded him at the time with a 80 fastball, 65 slider, 65 splitter, 50 curve, 50 change, 50 control, overall 70. And we're probably a little light on the bat. We went 50 hit, although then we went 70 power, 65 run, 80 arm, 50 field. So I think you could have argued him number one, not just top 10, but number one either way.
And how old was he then?
24, I believe.
Okay. So he was at the upper edge of, you know, still qualifying to be prospect eligible. Whereas here we're talking about someone who's 20 years old, not as polished, not as proven. It certainly makes for an interesting debate whether you take him or Grayson Rodriguez, our top-ranked pitching prospect in baseball. I have a feeling a lot of people would say that they would go with the guy who's doing this against the higher-level competition and dominantly so.
Could you argue? I mean, it's small sample size. I mean, Japanese. I think Japanese baseball is somewhere in between AAA and the big leagues. I don't think it's like the same level as Major League Baseball. So it's not like Grayson Rodriguez is too far off. I would give...
No, it's not too far off.
You know, I think Japanese baseball, in my mind, is probably closer to the AAA than the big leagues. I'd give it an edge over AAA, but, and I'm sure now I'm going to get killed on Twitter for saying that, but like, it's not too much of a different level. I'm going to fight for Grayson Rodriguez.
All right. Well, thanks very much to Advanced Stats 23 for that question. And thanks again to Matt McClain for joining us on the show. That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.